It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson in for Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll find out why the Wisconsin-based company Johnson Controls signed on to a White House climate pledge.
First, Gannett Wisconsin Media kicked off a new investigative series yesterday called Wisconsin Justice. They start with a look at sentencing in the state. Gannett looked at data from the past decade and found that some judges are known as harsh, while others are known as soft when it comes to sentencing.
Eric Litke is with us to talk about the series. He's an investigative reporter for Gannett Wisconsin Media. Eric, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
We'll start with a quote from your piece there. Justice in Wisconsin is less a scale than a roulette wheel. Landing in one courtroom could lead to probation, another to a decade behind bars. So is that an exaggeration? Is that much disparity depending on what county you're in, what judge you go before?
You know, this series grew out of me spending close to a decade as a cops reporter and seeing that cases that seemed pretty similar on their face were very different in the final outcome based on which judge they happened to land before. And so we kind of set out to say, is there an objective way to see if this is the case? And it turns out I think we can say pretty clearly that it is. Looking at the last decade of felony sentencing data, you can see that an identical crime, if you take something as specific as like a fifth or sixth offense OWI, and you go to one county, you can see there's one judge in a number of cases that maybe has a 15-month average sentence for that crime, while just down the hall, same county, same crime, that could be 25 months in prison on average. So over the course of a decade, you're looking at a 10-month difference for the same crime. So it really does depend largely on the judge that you happen to draw. And so that's kind of what brought the roulette wheel metaphor to mind. We assume there's a level of fairness and consistency within the justice system, but that doesn't always seem to be the case here.
Now, you went through a whole mess of data of sentencing information around the state and found these discrepancies, as you say, between counties and in some cases, as you just mentioned, you know, among judges within one county. Do we have any idea what leads to this inconsistency from one courtroom to the next?
The key thing is really a lack of oversight and a lack of data that's available to the judges. I had a number of different law professors and judges themselves bring up metaphors like a silo or a bubble to describe how the judges are really incredibly isolated from one another. There's no sentencing guidelines on a statewide basis that would say, for this type of crime, here's the range of typical sentence, you know, unless there's some kind of extreme circumstance. It's really left to the judge to say, okay, should the sentence for this be zero? Should it be a 20-year or 40-year maximum? Because the legislature certainly sets out a maximum penalty, but it's to the whim, to the experience of the sentencing judge to decide where in that range that falls. And so there's no guidelines to say here's what should happen. And perhaps the more surprising thing is there's no data even provided to the judges on what has happened in the past. Judges often push back against guidelines because of the discretion that it takes away from them. But even to be able to say, okay, so for this crime, whether it's battery, whether it's an OWI homicide, here's the range of sentences that have been given on this crime in my county, in my district, in the whole state of Wisconsin, just to kind of have that information to start with, right? To say, okay, this is I think worse than an average crime, so it should be above that, or this is less than an average crime, it should be below that. So there's nothing to give a point of reference.
Talking to Eric Litke from Gannett Wisconsin Media about sentencing disparities from courtroom to courtroom, from judge to judge here in Wisconsin, same crime, very different sentences depending on who is up in front of you in the courtroom. Let's drill down into one of the crimes you just mentioned, OWI homicides. What kind of disparities do we see there?
Sure. Now, these were a crime that we didn't include kind of in the overall analysis because there is such a variety of circumstances that those can happen in. But it's a tremendous disparity basically because there are judges that treat an OWI homicide case as a tragic accident. And, you know, kind of everyone has bad luck sometime. And then there's others that say this was a intentional act of driving while you're drunk and you caused the death just as if you went up to someone and shot him. So you draw a tremendous range with that. So looking at the period that we did from 2005 to 2014, the median sentence was about 5 years. But over that span, we had 76 of the 300 people were sentenced to less than a year behind bars, and about that same number got 10 years or more. And as we look down to some of the specific cases, it wasn't that there was a certain type of crime or type of OWI homicide that led to one as opposed to the other. In some cases, there's a judge that said, you know, the crime killed your wife or your husband, so it's enough that you are without them. You're punished enough. There's nothing else we can do. And then they let them off with, you know, maybe jail time and a little probation. There's also a case where a driver killed a fiance and got, I believe it was 20 years in prison. And the judge said, regardless of whatever personal loss you suffered, we need to make a statement here that this action is not okay in the state of Wisconsin. So, again, an identical crime, very different results in different courtrooms.
Now, your findings in this collection of data are going to be new to a lot of people, but there's one group who's not going to be surprised. That's defense attorneys and what you call frequent flyer defendants, people in courts a lot. It appears that they know this, and you measure one indicator of that, requests to switch judges. Can you talk about how that plays out?
Sure. Defendants are given one judicial do-over per case, essentially. They're allowed to say, I do not want this judge. They don't get to choose who the new judge is. That's assigned by the system on a random basis, varies by county. But they can say, not this guy. And so that gives you a real clear window into what at least the perception is of perceived sentencing harshness. There's no reason that goes on the record in terms of why this is done, but just talking to attorneys around the state, generally you file a substitution request to avoid a judge that you believe is going to be a harsh sentencer in some way. And when you start looking at a couple of counties, you get a real clear picture of how that varies. For example, in Sheboygan County, there's a Judge James Bulgert who's developed a significant reputation as a lenient sentencer. And on the other side, you have Judge Angela Sutkevich, who's developed a reputation as a harsh sentencer. Over the last 5 years, Bulgert's had two substitution requests, all of his felonies, 5 years, two substitution requests. Sutkevich has had 350. Outagamie County has an even more extreme example of one judge with more than 1,000 substitution requests, and no other judge in the county had more than 100. So there are the people that know these systems best know that there is a difference between these judges, and they're specifically targeting these judges as the ones to avoid. From talking to folks within the jail system, these are things that the defendants themselves know as well. That if you get this particular judge, you've really won the judicial lottery.
So some judges, people might say, oh, they're too lax. Some people might say, oh, no, those other judges are too tough. But it sounds like the key that is missing here is consistency. So what kind of things are people looking at to create more consistency from judge to judge, from county to county?
Well, a big piece of it can be the sentencing guidelines. Minnesota has done this for the last number of years and has seen a marked increase in the consistency and realize kind of the side benefit of if you have more consistent sentences, you have a more predictable size of your prison population. So they've been able to eliminate some overcrowding problems on that end as well. So their system essentially has a way to create a kind of numerical factor for the different elements of the case, the criminal history of the defendant, aggravating factors within that particular offense that was committed. And they kind of pile those all together and it gives you, okay, within this sentencing range, here's where this crime should probably fall. Judges are still given the discretion to go outside that range if they feel like they need to for whatever reason, and they need to state those reasons. And the sentence can be appealed to a higher court if they do go outside that. But there is a assumption that most cases are going to be sentenced within that. And lacking that, to have, like I discussed, to have some way to at least let judges have that information. If you're going to continue to give them the complete discretion, then to at least let them say, okay, I'm going to exercise this discretion within this context, that I know here's what this sentence has, or what this crime has yielded sentence-wise, locally, and statewide.
So we don't have this kind of sentencing guideline in place in Wisconsin now, as I understand it. Have we had it in the past?
There have been two different attempts over the last 20 years to impose some guidelines. Both of them were advisory guidelines, however, as opposed to binding, so it created some additional paperwork for judges, which many of them chafed at, and it ultimately was not really a true guideline system because it's saying here's kind of the suggested range without having any of the meat or the power behind it to say, no, this is what you're required to do. And so we'll be delving into that in a little more detail later on in the series, of kind of why those commissions failed. But yeah, that's something that has not been in place to any degree in Wisconsin since 2007.
And who would be the decider? Who would have to change things to give us either sentencing guidelines, mandatory or advisory, or a sentencing commission?
That's a legislative decision to create a body like that and decide how much power to give them. There are administrative officers within the state court system that would have the ability to aggregate some of this data and at least create this and say, here, judges, this is the sentencing information that we have for this crime. But they right now don't have the authority, they haven't been instructed to do that, and they don't have the resources to do that because that is a fairly time and labor intensive thing to undertake. And the thing I was told by the head of the Office of Court Operations is that they are right now a pretty significant investment away from being able to provide that kind of information to judges.
Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Eric Litke, investigative reporter for Gannett, Wisconsin Media. He was with us to talk about a new series on circuit court judges in Wisconsin. It's called Wisconsin Justice. You can see the first installment in the series, more on what we've just been talking about, over at the Central Time Facebook page.
Today marks the first day of the world's largest conference on climate change. Leaders from around the globe are meeting in Paris for the next week and a half to hammer out an agreement on stemming carbon emissions and holding down rising temperatures.
In attendance will be representatives of a Wisconsin company, Johnson Controls, which joined 80 other American companies in signing on to the Obama administration's American Business Act on Climate pledge. The company, based in Glendale, Wisconsin, sells products and services geared toward energy efficiency.
As part of the initiative, each company has announced its own goals for how it will contribute to reducing carbon emissions in the coming years. Here with us now is Clay Nessler, Vice President of Global Energy and Sustainability at Johnson Controls. He'll be in Paris later this week. Clay, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
So why did Johnson Controls decide to sign on to the president's initiative?
Well, actually, it was very natural for us to do. As many of your listeners know, Johnson Controls is a Wisconsin-based global multi-industrial company. We have operations in 150 countries around the world, and we've made public commitments around sustainability and greenhouse gas emissions since 2003. For instance, from 2002 to 2014, we actually reduced our global greenhouse gas intensity by 41%. And we've consistently made public commitments, set goals. We've achieved those goals, and then we've continued to make additional commitments over the years. And that's essentially what the American Business Act on Climate pledge is all about: identifying areas where you can make a positive impact, setting goals, making them public, reporting on your progress. We joined 80 other U.S. companies in making the pledge.
And so looking at this specific layer of your commitment to combating climate change at Johnson Controls, under that American Business Act on Climate pledge, what are you saying that you as a company will do, and in what time period?
Yeah. We've publicly made commitments within the last year to reduce our greenhouse gas intensity, which is our metric tons of emissions divided by our revenue, by 15%. So that's going beyond the 41% that we've already made. Additionally, we made a commitment to reduce our energy intensity of our operations by another 15%. So those are quantitative goals. We also, in our pledge, identified two other areas of commitment. One is we're working with our small and medium enterprise suppliers to help them improve the energy efficiency and resource efficiency of their operations through tools and training. We have a process that we use within our own 300-plus manufacturing facilities around the world, which are called energy hunts, where we look for low-cost and no-cost measures, training energy champions and teams in our plants to go in and looking for opportunities for lighting retrofits to improve the efficiency of heating, ventilating, air conditioning equipment, looking to find compressed air leaks and getting the operators and the shop floor personnel involved in turning things off. those practices are very universal, and we're now taking our best practices to our supply base. When we looked at our environmental footprint, we found that our upstream supply chain actually has five times the environmental impact as our own operations within our own plants, facilities, vehicles, and our own operational footprint. So we can have a very large impact just by sharing our best practice with our suppliers.
We're talking with Clay Nessler, Vice President of Global Energy and Sustainability at Johnson Controls. It's a Wisconsin company that is making significant commitments to combating climate change and will be attending the Paris Climate Summit later this week. So, Clay, the goal is to stem climate change, but there are also implications, obviously, for your business in taking these things on. What would you say are the positives and maybe negatives from a financial or a growth perspective?
Well, Johnson Controls is a leader in energy efficiency in both the building sector as well as in the vehicle sector. So our advanced technology batteries are used in cars to promote start-stop operation. This is technology which is relatively new in the U.S., but very well established in Europe, where when you pull up to a stoplight or a stop sign and you put your foot on the brake, the car engine actually turns off. And then when you release the brake, the engine turns back on. That's a technology which can provide 5 to 10% or 5 to 8%, let's say, vehicle fuel efficiency at a relatively low cost compared to other more advanced technologies in vehicles. So that's a great example where technology today can make a very big impact in emissions. Similarly, in the building side, ever since our founder, Professor Warren Johnson, invented the room thermostat about 130 years ago, we've been improving the energy efficiency and reducing energy use in buildings. We find that in both new and existing buildings, we can reduce the energy use by 25 to 50%. The interesting thing about energy efficiency is it's not a cost to make these improvements. It's actually an investment. So instead of spending money in energy waste through utility bills, being able to invest in the improvements, pay for them over time using a variety of contracting methods, it actually provides a positive return to the owners of the buildings. And we find that that's a real opportunity as we look at climate change. It's not just a cost. It actually is an investment because it pays for itself over time in both vehicles and in buildings.
I want to go back to something you said, Clay. You said that a lot of those innovations, especially you were talking about the automotive innovations, are much more common and much more commonly used in Europe than in the United States. To what do you attribute that difference?
Well, Europe has long worked as sort of a common collection of member states, and the price of energy is very high, and that promotes the use of energy efficiency. The price of gasoline, for instance, at our pumps is, if you've ever traveled to Europe, you'll know that it's multiple times less expensive than the gasoline or diesel in Europe, which is very popular. So that drives investment in energy efficiency solutions. So price is one factor, and also incentives. We find in the U.S., for instance, that the federal government and many state and local governments, including the state of Wisconsin, have taken great advantage of what's called performance contracting, where a government entity would work with a energy performance contractor like Johnson Controls, which is a large business for us, and basically make all the improvements in the buildings, work with a third-party financial institution to finance those and pay for those improvements over time, reducing energy costs, reducing the environmental impact, without a net impact to taxpayers or the utility ratepayers. So I think it works in both Europe and the United States.
So you will be attending the Paris conference later in the week. What will you personally be doing there as a representative of Johnson Controls?
Yes, I'm actually leaving for Paris tomorrow, and I'll be traveling with Grady Crosby, who's our Vice President of Public Affairs and Diversity. And we will be very active participating in roundtables and in panel discussions. I will be accredited to go into the negotiating areas. So I'll be participating in, I believe, 7 different speaking engagements, primarily working with NGOs, environmental NGOs, civil society, and really representing Johnson Controls as well as the private sector as a whole, basically talking about the role of innovation, the role of market-based mechanisms, so taking advantage of the private sector to make these improvements and to make greater, more ambitious reductions through cooperation between the public sector and the private sector.
Well, Clay, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
We've been talking to Clay Nessler, Vice President of Global Energy and Sustainability at Johnson Controls. He'll be in Paris later this week representing the Wisconsin-based company at the Global Climate Change Conference.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Veronica Rickert. The 2016 presidential election is projected to cost $5 billion, more than double the price tag in 2012.
With so much money pouring into the election of our next president, our next guest questions if we can really continue to say the U.S. government is of, for, and by the people.
Critic Lewis Lapham actually questions whether that has ever been the nature of our government, saying that when the country has had to choose between moneyed interests and democracy, it usually chooses those moneyed interests.
Lewis Lapham is with us now. He's the editor of Lapham's Quarterly and editor emeritus of Harper's Magazine. His article in the November issue of Harper's is called Bombast Bursting in Air, the story so far of the 2016 election. Lewis, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. I'm glad to be in Central Time.
Well, you start your piece with a quote from Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis. We must make our choice, quoting here, we may have democracy or we may have wealth concentrated in the hands of a few. We can't have both. You say we've decided, and it's we've decided more or less on the wealth concentrated in the hands of a few. Talk that out for us.
Well, I mean, that's I think that Brandeis was right in saying that. On the other hand, when the country, the foundation of the country with the Constitution in 1787 in Philadelphia, what those people have, they're all landowners. They're either rich merchants from New England or they're plantation owners from the South, but they are landed gentry. And their notion is an enlightened oligarchy, which is they call a republic, which is what Franklin says that they're trying to do, and it's the same kind of they're taking their ideas not only from the French Enlightenment and the late 18th century England, but also from Aristotle. And Aristotle makes the point that all government, no matter what you call it, whether you call it democracy, whether you call it plutocracy, whether you call it oligarchy, is essentially in the hands of relatively few people. And Madison says that. He says what we're trying to do is set up a government to be directed by men with the wisdom to discern and the virtue to pursue the common good of the society. Thomas Paine, who had written Common Sense and wrote the Crisis Papers during the Revolutionary War, has a different idea of democracy. His is a really popular democracy of the people, by the people. And he says that the strength of government is the strength of the people to mutually support one another. That's that strength of the government and the happiness of the governed. But that is really not what we start out with. In the early 19th century, it goes into a kind of democracy that's essentially all about money. And Jefferson and Adams, although they were at odds with each other in the election of 1800, as they get older, they're Jefferson's in Monticello and Adams is in Braintree, Massachusetts, and they start writing each other letters. And this is the subject that is in their correspondence. And Jefferson says at one point, money, not morality, is the principle of commercial nations. And they both sort of see that the Republican idea has gone the way, you know, gone where the woodbine twine is. And then they both die. They both die in 1826 on the same day, July 4th. Jackson comes in with a spoils system where everything is for sale, and then the men who wrote the Constitution, I mean, did not, that kind of an oligarchy didn't continue to exist, because if it's going to be an enlightened oligarchy, the people have to pay attention and they have to put more emphasis on their store of virtue than on their hoards of wealth. And that doesn't happen, so they can't, they don't have enough wisdom or virtue to rid the Republic of slavery. That happens in the Civil War. And then Lincoln, in the Gettysburg Address in 1863, gives the country its noble myth: government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
Talking to Lewis Lapham about American government and elections, he says not government of the people, by the people, and for the people, but in the hands of the wealthy people, in effect. And Lewis, I want to take us into the 2016 election now. Since the period you've talked about, the franchise expanded, more people with the vote, but you say the moneyed people are still calling the shots. Our elections are an elaborate form of political theater now.
Yes, they are, and they have been for some time. I mean, elections are always political theater, but I mean, what the elections are, the less democracy we have in fact on the ground in office, the more of it we have to have in virtual reality. In other words, the election it lasts for almost 4 years. And what it is telling us the story that, yes, Virginia, we still have a government of the people, by the people, for the people. And here are a cast of characters with supposedly different opinions, making a show of themselves. And we have sound bites, and we have people. You know, we have Iowa caucuses, and then we have New Hampshire caucuses, and we have a lot of constant commentary in the news media, drumming up the excitement of a Democratic race for the White House roses. And what it really is a show. It's an entertainment. It's a let's pretend democracy. It's the show of democracy. It's not the thing itself. And one of the problems, of course, is that, I mean, the candidates are made by and for the camera. And the camera doesn't do democracy very well. I mean, the democracy is about words. It's about thought. It's about listening to people other than oneself. It's about candor. It's about telling the truth, or trying to tell the truth to each other. Probably one of the finest books on American democracy ever that I know is James Fenimore Cooper, published in 1837, called The American Democrat. And he says that the first principle of democracy is candor. Unless we try to tell each other what we know, what we have seen and experienced on our common journey, it's all a sham. And as you know, and as practically everybody else in the country also knows, is that what the candidates are saying is seldom the truth. They're not trying to tell the truth. They're trying to pitch. It's a sales pitch to a target audience. You say one thing to blacks, you say another thing to gays, you say another thing to unions, and so on. I mean, nobody is talking to their fellow Americans. They're talking to a demographic. They're pitching themselves the same way the advertising a product is pitched to a particular zip code or prejudice or prior arrest record.
We're hearing from Lewis Lapham, editor of Lapham's Quarterly, editor emeritus of Harper's Magazine. His latest piece in Harper's is called Bombast Bursting in Air, Looking at the 2016 Presidential Election.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think Lewis Lapham is right? What do you make of the news that this presidential election will cost $5 billion? Where do you think we should do about it? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation with Lewis Lapham, editor of Lapham's Quarterly and editor emeritus of Harper's Magazine. His article in the November issue of Harper's is called Bombast Bursting in Air.
In his piece, he makes the case that our presidential elections are more theater than substantive choice, that our government is more in the hands of the wealthy, more of a plutocracy or oligarchy than democracy. Do you agree, or do you think we really do have meaningful choices to make amongst our presidential candidates? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Lewis, if it is this way, if people don't like it, is there a realistic alternative? What would have to happen to make our representative government representative?
Well, I mean, there are a number of things. What one could do immediately would be, in 2016, would be to vote for Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders is actually, he's an avowed socialist, but he's running on, I mean, his campaign is democracy. I mean, he is along the lines of Fenimore Cooper. He's also along the lines of Tom Paine. He's along the lines of the progressive side of Teddy Roosevelt and also the Franklin Roosevelt New Deal. And the so that would be one thing that you could do. Another thing we should do is to revise the Constitution so that we're not voting for an electoral college. In other words, I'm in New York, and New York, no matter who votes, what anybody does, New York will go Democratic because of the way the electoral college is set up and the way the vote is counted. So I'm not voting. My vote for the president won't count. And it wouldn't count if I was a Republican either. I mean, and it only counts in relatively few states, the so-called swing states. But California will be Democratic, Texas will be Republican, and so on. So it's not a one vote, one person setup. So we might. We might want to revise the Constitution. The people who wrote the Constitution expected it to be revised from time to time. They knew that you couldn't set something in stone in the 18th century that it would be pertinent or relevant necessarily to a situation in the 21st century. But they left that open, and we've amended the Constitution a number of times. We should probably amend it again. And we might even want to change we might want to have a parliamentary system of government in the way they have it in England rather than the way we have it set up now, because the circumstances are different.
Ed Lewis, I want to bring in a caller now. We've got Bob on the line in Green Bay. Bob, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to mention that, you know, it seems like right now we have the lesser of two evils, and I would really love to see, like, you know, half a dozen different parties with real opinions rather than just pandering to, you know, the biggest mass that they can. I'd be curious to hear what your thoughts are on that.
No, I'd like to see the same thing, but to get there, you would have to amend or revise the Constitution.
Bob, thanks a lot for that call. So that said, Lewis, short of changing our electoral system to have more than two parties, is there a way to have more diversity of viewpoint other than two people, in effect, to choose from come Election Day?
No, if you don't change the system we've got now, that's the way it will come down. And the various candidates, I mean, we go through the primary system, where people are not judged really on their ideas. They're just judged on their, you know, for the camera, personality. It's television reality show. That's why Trump understands this. And with a television camera, you know, you only get a few seconds. It's hard to make a complicated argument in whatever, 45 seconds or 2 minutes. I mean, the Lincoln-Douglas debates went on for 3 hours, people standing around in the sun. In 1800, the population was 3 million people in the new United States, and only a few, the majority didn't have the vote. There was no direct election of senators. There had to be a property qualification. Slaves couldn't vote. Women couldn't vote. And also, most of the people that were voting were literate. And we now have large numbers of people in this country that are, according to the Department of Public Education, functionally illiterate. And democracy is a very hard form of government to do it. It's extremely difficult because you've got to listen to a lot of different people. You've got to have people who think for themselves, who have the courage to say what they think. And that's not easy. So, yes, we could change it. I mean, but you'd have to work on it. I mean, Sanders actually says this. I mean, when he's talking in his campaign, he says what needs to happen is a lot of people have to want to make the change. It takes a revolution in which a lot of people are involved, not just specific interest groups. I mean, the way our politics is now broken up into talking to very targeted, old Americans, young Americans, black Americans, and so forth and so on. And that's not citizenship. You're talking to consumers or customers rather than you're talking to citizens, and it's not participatory.
Bob, thanks for that call as we talk to Lewis Lapham. Lewis, as we wrap up, in the piece we're talking about, you point the finger in part at the media, saying they wouldn't take somebody like, say, Bernie Sanders seriously, somebody who tries to step outside the system of big money. What would you like to see from the media in its political coverage?
Well, I think I'd like to see less of it. But of course, the media has got a real interest in this, in staging this, the theater. I mean, of that $5 billion is going to be spent, a great deal of it is going to be spent for advertising in the media or for supporting various newsletters and newspapers and magazines with political theater. I mean, it's kind of a reality show, and I think it would it, I think you have to go about the television debates in a different way. Give people more time, have fewer people. I think you should limit the campaigning system to, you know, maybe in England it's 3 months. I mean, maybe we could do six, but just cut down on the nonsense and stop, you know, playing it for celebrity, which is the way the media plays it. But that's the media's lifeblood, so it would be hard to get the media to give it up.
All right, we'll leave it there. Lewis Lapham, thanks for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
We've been talking to Lewis Lapham. He is editor of Lapham's Quarterly and editor emeritus of Harper's Magazine. We've been talking about his piece in Harper's. It's called Bombast Bursting in Air, the story so far of the 2016 election. And you can check that out and continue the conversation, by the way. Share your thoughts on it. Head over to the Central Time Facebook page for a look at that. A massive pop music milestone today. On this day in 1982, Michael Jackson's album Thriller was released.
Thriller is the top-selling album of all time in the United States and around the world. And after Jackson's death in 2009, he became the first artist to see over a million music downloads in 1 week, led by the songs from Thriller.
Then there were the videos. Jackson and Thriller opened the door to African-American performers in the early day of MTV. By the way, this is back when MTV used to show music videos. That was their thing then. That's what they started out doing. The 14-minute video for the title track, Thriller, inspires viral video performances to this day. You see people recreating the big zombie dance sequences.
And I totally remember watching Thriller.
Oh, yeah.
And it really, I mean, first of all, music videos were pretty new back then. But but that 14-minute, it was like a mini movie.
Right,
it was
exactly.
Really groundbreaking.
And I just remember back then, we were talking earlier, this even not everybody liked Thriller, but everybody knew about Thriller. This was the dominant thing in
right.
pop culture, not just in 82, but for like 2-3 years.
Right. And I will tell people, I am doing my best Thriller moves right now. Unfortunately, we are on the radio. So.
It's I'll get my camera out. Oh, we're out of time.